Hello, I'm Annie Hastwell. Welcome to Let's Think About It, where Radio Adelaide brings you a selection of the many ideas that this city's heard over the years, both at the Adelaide Festival of Ideas and at Writers Week. Some ideas just live on and we like to give them a second chance. In today's choice from the Festival of Ideas vault, we hear from Adelaide's own Robin Archer. Robin is a singer, performer, writer, artistic director, and a passionate advocate for the arts. Prepare yourself for a trip through history and some very fine poetry. In this talk, Observations of a Freelance Artist, she asks, just how free are the arts to really critique our society? And do we really have the freedom and democracy we congratulate ourselves on? On stage at the Adelaide Town Hall in 2018, here's Robin Archer.
The words freedom and democracy have long acquired a status of unquestionability, just like jobs and growth. They are words which lure us unwittingly into the equally questionable territory of core values, things to be treasured when we have them and fought for when we don't. My experience is that the minute you start to dig a little deeper into the meanings of those words, you discover infinite shades of interpretation and misunderstanding. It is widely assumed that when the democratically elected representatives we choose to govern the country on our behalf all join in the chorus of jobs and growth, the majority of the populace is content with the idea that they are the most important things to consider in our lives, for our futures, and for the future harmony and stability of our country. Yet scientist Brian Walker questions this continuing cry for growth when what the planet urgently demands is reduction, urgent reduction of our consumption, our waste, our carbon footprint. And why the illusion of endless job creation when Japanese roboticist Hiroshi Ishiguro asserts that the process of evolution over the next 1,000 years or so will see us as no longer organic because the planet will no longer be able to support the organic human. Everything that we know now and are and feel as humans may have been fed into robotic forms, which by then will be much cleverer, more durable, more perceptive, and perhaps even more sensitive than we are, and will not demand the organic forms of food and water and clean air which the planet can no longer supply. The organic human form may, by then, have found somewhere else in the universe to colonise, but here on Earth we might be over. Or, as asks the T-shirt, observed at London's Victoria and Albert Museum for the current exhibition, The Future Starts Here, if Mars is the answer, what is the question? Why focus on job models now hundreds of years old? Robots are already capable of doing most of the jobs we do and will take over so many more in the future. Current thinking on the future of jobs seems no more advanced today than it was when communism's hope was that the machine age would free us up from daily drudgery and leave us all so many more hours for creative pursuits. This is what the smart robot will tell you right now in almost exactly the same words. I'm going to do all that dreary work for you so you will have more time for creativity. But who is teaching us? Who is preparing us for this surfeit of creative hours? Where was the army of educators preparing an entire generation for the casualisation of labour? We artists have learned to deal with insecurity, flexibility, constant change, and the gifts which sometimes unexpected periods of free time can offer. But free time outside the creative professions appears to be not so much about free thinking and the pursuit of knowledge, but having holidays and acquiring more status symbols. Thus, I question jobs and growth, and of course, in some quarters, this will already be considered heresy, somewhat un-Australian or un-American, not to accept, just on face value, that jobs and growth are unquestionably the most important things. And remember, I have earned my living for more than 40 years now only by contract. Never an ounce of security, no holiday pay, no sick pay, no overtime, no such thing as scheduled weekends or nights off. I don't turn up, I don't get paid. So I don't speak from a privileged position of a secure job. Growth, I question, and jobs have already changed and will change again. I question these notions, happy to be convinced that they are the most important things if someone can argue convincingly for them. But I demand their interrogation, just as I do freedom and democracy. Just so, the poet and playwright Bertolt Brecht questioned these ideas and in 1947 brutally satirised the catch cry of freedom and democracy. They too are words which are now being challenged and interrogated anew. I should say early on that the two things, freedom and democracy, are related, but neither guarantees the other, nor are either as easily defined as most imagine. Brecht's poem was written in 1947, presumably in California, whence Brecht departed in October of that year, the day after testifying before the House Un-American Activities Committee. This committee, which appealed to Americans to denounce fellow Americans, was set up in the context of American democracy, as my late mentor's wife, Anne Willett, would always refer to it. Having fled Germany's National Socialism, now fleeing America's democracy from California, Brecht spent a year in Zurich, but returned to Berlin in the years of construction, probably because of the offer to have a theatre there. What kind of a person does it take to look something squarely in the eye, without compromise, to understand just how bad it is, yet still have hope, and in this case, more importantly, to believe that a theatre company could help to change things? Brecht was inspired by Percy Shelley's poem of 1819, which he wrote after receiving news of the Peterloo Massacre in Manchester. Shelley's poem had been submitted to the Examiner in the same year, and after his death in 1822, his widow Mary Shelley also submitted it, but it was not published until 1832, more than 20 years after it was written. John Mullen has written, "Shelley's friend, the publisher Leigh Hunt, felt that it could not be safely published. So-called gagging acts had been introduced to restrict published political protest. The perpetrators of the massacre had already been exonerated, but the organisers of the demonstration had been imprisoned." Shelley's Mask of Anarchy describes a parade of the ghastly powers: murder, fraud, hypocrisy, and finally anarchy. Pale and mounted on a white horse, anarchy has a mark on his brow. "I am God and king and law." For me, whose politics were eventually shaped by the songs of the American protest movement of the 1960s, I hear in my own teenage voice, as well as that of Bob Dylan, whose songs I sang with passion, "with God on my side." In Shelley's poem, anarchy represents the abusive and disruptive forces of those in power, trampling the multitudes who have surrendered to him and his followers, priests, bankers, monarchs. Hope is portrayed as a frail maiden, only rescued by the masses who in this prophetic vision choose at last to resist the grotesques oppressing them. "And if then the tyrants dare, let them ride among you there, slash and stab and maim and hew, what they like, then let them do, with folded arms and steady eyes, and little fear and less surprise, look upon them as they slay, till their rage has died away." It is a very definition of passive resistance and was inspirational stuff. In London a few weeks ago, breezing through Tate Britain, I accidentally came across the J.M.W. Turner painting, originally thought to relate to the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, but was in fact his response to this same poem. The Brecht poem stares at post-war Germany with uncompromising gaze. The thing I have most admired is this poet's never-failing ability to see and describe the worst and not avert his gaze, to maintain that there is always bad in the good and good in the bad. Think of Mother Courage. How do we feel such sympathy for a woman profiteering from war? It's because he refuses to observe her, or more importantly, let us observe her through a prism of cliché. He attempts to get at unadorned truths. Are we any longer able to see clearly? Are we able to pierce the clouds, sometimes walls of cliché and half-truths and deliberate omission, to see what's going on? Should this skill top the list of basic education for all? Is there not the most urgent need for every human being, young and old, to be educated in the crafts of analysis and perception, for all of us to have an equal chance to determine some authentic version of the truth? Not only does Brecht not shy away from admitting what he really sees and telling it like it is, but he actually described this vision of post-war Germany and, with choices open to him, decided to return there. Freedom and Democracy, Bertolt Brecht, translated by John Willett. Spring returned to Germany. In the ruins you could see early green birch leaves unfold, graceful, tentative and bold. As from many a southern valley, voters left their homes to rally, forming a disjointed column underneath two banners solemn, whose supports were all worm-eaten, their inscription weather-beaten, though its gist appeared to be freedom and democracy. Every church bell started ringing. Soldiers, widows, airmen's women, orphaned, shell-shocked, crippled, raped, open-mouthed, the watchers gaped. And the deaf could tell the blind who it was that marched behind. Such a slogan as may be, freedom and democracy. At the head, a feather brain sang with all his might and main, Allons enfants, God save the king and the dollar, cling, cling, cling. In several verses, Brecht observes the poorly hidden traces of Nazi sympathisers, all now equally bellowing for freedom and democracy. He continues, Then the faceless trust directors, those men's patrons and protectors, pray for our arms industry, freedom and democracy. Keeping step, next march the teachers, toadying, brain-corrupting creatures for the right to educate boys to butchery and hate. Then the medical advisers, Hitler's slaves, mankind's despisers, asking might they now select a few reds to vivisect. Three grim dons whose reputation rests on mass extermination stake their claim for chemistry, freedom and democracy. After them behold the former editors of Streicher's Stürmer, all set to protest unless we get freedom of the press. Next in line, honest taxpayers, once renowned as Semite slayers, gagged today, want guarantees for the new minorities. As for those parliamentarians who in Hitler's day were Aryans and now pose as barristers, freedom for such gifts as theirs. While the black market man asked why he came out on the march, unconditionally replies to preserve free enterprise. And the judge, now this is rich, wields outmoded laws by which, Hitlerized up to the hilt, he finds men like himself not guilty. Poets, painters and musicians seeking grub and good positions, noble souls who now assure us they were no friends of the Führer's. Strength through joy dames, spies, jubaters, Gestapo investigators, tax gifts, interest stimulators, irredentist liberators. Blood and dirt, elective allies, winding over hills and valleys, belched, stank, squitted out their plea, freedom and democracy. And then the parade reaches Munich. Misinformed in misery, see its baffled bourgeoisie standing where their houses stood, lacking certainties and food. As the smelly column staggers through the rubble with its banners, by the brown house there's a surge, and six silent shades emerge. In six cars, those six assorted party members are transported, while the crowd shouts, Now we'll see freedom and democracy. And he goes on to describe these three monstrous shades in the six cars bringing up the rear. Bony hand grasping a whip, first oppression takes a trip, in a half track furnished free by our heavy industry. In a rusty tank much greeted, next comes plague, his breath is fetid. To conceal his flaking skin, he wraps a brown scarf round his chin. After him see fraud appear, brandishing a jug of beer. You will get your glasses filled when you have let him take your children. Older than the hills and yet still out for what he can get, stupidity staggers on board. Riveted he stares at fraud. Lolling back as at a play, murder too is on the way. Perfectly at ease as he hums sweet dream of liberty. Shaken by the latest crisis, robbery materialises. In field marshal's uniform with the globe tucked under arm. Each of these six grisly figures, firmly based with ready triggers, says that there has got to be freedom and democracy. Lurching, a huge hearse came last, once those six monsters have passed, inside which unseen and wretched, who can tell what race lies stretched? Cold winds blow a requiem from the ruins over them, former tenants of the flats that once stood here, then great rats. Leave the rubble in their masses, join the column as it passes, squeaking freedom as they flee, freedom and democracy. Can any of us imagine seeing a country in that way and choosing to go there? To return there, even though we had a perfect setup, not to have to return. Choosing to return and to make things better. Is it possible that one of the many criteria we might adopt to define freedom is the ability to look things squarely in the face, sometimes the worst of things, and not gloss over them nor run away from them, but choose to stay and try to fix them? Perhaps this is not just compassion or civil or human responsibility, but actually a part of what being free really means. Shelley's earlier poem suggested what freedom is. What art thou, freedom? Oh, could slaves answer from their living graves? This demand tyrants would flee like a dream's dim imagery. Thou art not, as impostors say, a shadow soon to pass away, a superstition and a name echoing from the cave of fame. For the labourer thou art bread and a comely table spread. From his daily labour come in a neat and happy home. Thou art clothes and fire and food for the trampled multitude. No, in countries that are free, such starvation cannot be as in England now we see. Thou art justice, ne'er for gold. May thy righteous laws be sold as laws are in England. Thou shieldst alike the high and low. Thou art wisdom. Free men never dream that God will damn forever all who think those things untrue of which priests make such ado. Science, poetry and thought are thy lamps. They make the lot of the dwellers in a cot so serene they curse it not. Spirit, patience, gentleness, all that can adorn and bless art thou. Let deeds, not words, express thine exceeding loveliness. In the wake of Brecht's poem, there was a challenge to artistic freedoms, and there's a whole other can of worms. At the outset, let's just be clear that artists are not completely free, not even in our own great democracy, or indeed in other great Western democracies. One of the songs I sang last night in the third of my Arts Centre Melbourne concerts probably offended some in the audience, but I am free to sing it. From the Threepenny Opera, the Ballad of Sexual Obsession, included back in the programme for obvious reasons at this time, a song written 90 years ago and still frighteningly pertinent in this moment. In other places in the world today, it would certainly have me silenced and perhaps jailed. I have often said that the arts are the safest place for a dangerous conversation. The question becomes, how do you set up that dangerous conversation when certain representations are no longer tolerated? The British playwright David Edgar spoke eloquently on this when Britain passed a law some years ago forbidding the glorification of terrorists or terrorist activities. He quoted the example of a playwright whose work had been accused in a newspaper review of sympathising with the terrorist character in his play. The young playwright sued the newspaper won, and bankrupted this emerging talent, who had portrayed on stage a jihadist much admired by his followers. The critic of the play had simply concluded wrongly that the playwright also admired this central character. That, of course, was not the case. And Edgar elaborated on the danger for all artists of being accused of direct association with the characters they portray on stage, in visual art, in novels. For some reason, it doesn't quite seem to count in the same way in films. Villains of all kinds fill our various screens. We don't attribute to the writer-director a positive association. Nevertheless, the question remains, how can you ever construct the dangerous conversation without successfully and explicitly depicting the most evil of forces? How can an artist give us the enormous privilege of entering into a context of moral dilemma without convincing us for a few hours that we ourselves are at risk and forcing us to decide where we stand on an issue or what we might do when faced with danger? All this without ever actually being in peril. How is that possible if you are not free to portray the villains and the way they are supported and encouraged by their followers, as well as those who expose them, the heroes, if you like? The case that arose indirectly from Brecht's poem concerned the freedom of the artist. In 1980, during the Bundestag elections, a group created a political theatre piece based on Brecht's poem. It was a street theatre pageant performed in various places throughout Germany with vehicles and costumes and portrayals of the monsters as in Brecht's poem, and the poem itself was sometimes read as part of the action. In a final car in the parade, appearing amongst the grotesques, was a figure interpreted as being one of the candidates in the upcoming election, Minister President Franz Josef Strauß. One local jurisdiction sued the actor for defamation, especially in implying a link between Strauss and the Nazis, and they won. The actor and company then took the case to the federal parliament and had that decision overturned. The federal decision was significant. The ruling was that street theatre cannot be separated from formal theatre or poetry or any other genre in terms of the protections given to artists. There's a fascinating description on that website of the failure to define art in absolutes, but a robust statement of the individual rights of artists to express their views without fear of breaking any law. And in fact, that very protection grew out of the worst excesses of silencing artists, that is, punishment and murder, for expressing opinions that differed from those of the ruling National Socialist Party in the 1930s. Not different from the Cultural Revolution under Madame Mao, or indeed the cultural dictates of many an oppressive regime. I'm loath, however, just to dwell on historical examples and claim us as somehow squeaky clean in all this. First of all, there are things which few would now not dare to include in art. I hesitate even to name the kinds of things which would see our exhibitions or plays shut down, our songs struck off, our books not published. I dare say that the majority of artists already exert a high degree of self-censorship in order not to cause problems for themselves or their colleagues. We are not free to say exactly what we think. Well, in some countries, artists and others may well be free to do so, as we are here, but at what cost? In recent times, both Catherine Deneuve and Germaine Greer have attracted huge criticism for saying what they actually think about the Me Too movement. And this is now in an atmosphere much changed from a time when a ticking off might happen in a mass media outlet and over in a few days. Don't mistake me. If Me Too manages to curb violent or uninvited excessive and predatory behaviour, especially when the inappropriate exercise of power over anyone is involved, then it's a good thing. It's a moment when hitherto self-suppressed voices are unleashed. But surely freedom and democracy should mean that critical voices can also be heard. That's the essence of the freedom, that we can have the conversation, not just jump on any popular bandwagon and make it hard for the real debate to occur. The dominance of social media now means that not only good and productive opinions can be widely shared, but outrage and misinformation and ignorance can be widespread a millionfold and last a very long time and have immediate effect and consequences. Majority opinion can now have devastating effects either way, and that goes for the process of democracy as well. In order not to attract public criticism, not to feel that an artist is putting their career in danger or their family's income in jeopardy, many core issues of humanity are not addressed in the arts, or if addressed, somewhat glossed over, not taken head on as in the Brecht poem. Or if addressed head on, what effect do they have? The visual artist Susan Norrie addresses environmental danger head on. Does it change policy? With similar concern, Tacita Dean portrays the landscape in monumental modes. Does the inspiration of landscape have just as powerful effect on policymakers as the political statement? Nothing like a shock to a policymaker to spring them into action. The undeniable vision of tortured dying sheep had a quick effect and rapid action. But does art ever have the same effect? For this reason, I suspect the comment of Amir Reza Kuistani remains forever with me. In a panel in Amsterdam, this Iranian playwright, who had already been conscripted into the army to do national service, who is still unable to get a visa to visit the USA, said he often found people saying how hard it must be for him to do his work in Iran. He said, "No, I do my work. I get shut down a few times a year. If I wasn't shut down, I'd know I'm not doing my job. Then he said, and this was the thrust, you know, in the West, you talk about your freedom of expression. You can say anything you want. I think you are free to say anything you want because no one is listening to you. And it's true. There are a couple of things that can shut an artist down in the current climate. We are all obliged as members of this democracy to obey the laws, whether we agree with them or not. This democracy limits many of our freedoms. We are forbidden, for instance, to take other people's lives, except if we are part of the defence forces who are obliged to kill on our behalf. But we are forbidden to take the life of someone we love most dearly, even when that person is in the worst extremities of pain and begs us to take their life. This, of course, yields up one of those powerful grotesques of our time, hypocrisy, since we know full well that a blessed form of assisted dying takes place every day in those places that house elderly people. We are living a lie and we simply choose to gloss over it. However, these are all things which in our democracy an artist is free to portray. Even with some sympathy or criticism of the killer, we are free to enter this dangerous conversation. But are we free to portray these things because no artist will ever stop war or get the law changed? No, that's not how it works. The artist finds a persuasive way to put the audience into that situation, and someone or several or many people in that audience feel something, and if they feel it deeply enough, they may be compelled to go out and do something about the situation. We are here free to criticise those we elected, but we have to be careful about how we criticise them, or that could lead to a defamation case. And interestingly, critics and comics in the United States are freer than we are in that respect. We are free to create works of art about the worst aspects of our society, let's say child abuse or domestic violence, but I doubt any artist is free to represent a child or wife abuser in any kind of positive light. A kind of Brechtian sympathy for even the minuscule good in an otherwise nasty character seems tricky these days. Even those who get close to the topic, simply portraying children in certain lights, for instance, can be shut down. Children in art, except in the most saccharine of contexts, become a no-go area. And satirising or interrogating religion is now a minefield. We may have the illusion of freedom of expression, but there are now many shades of freedom, many micro-moments of self-censorship, and the tendency not to fix the absolutely crystal-clear gaze and say exactly what one thinks. I've dwelt on the idea of freedom and the necessity to keep questioning what that word means rather than democracy, because it has surely become so evident that democracy is a loaded term. John Keane's excellent book, The Rise and Fall of Democracy, in its opening chapter, quickly dispels any mythology around the idea of democracy. He tells us it was not invented in Athens, but centuries earlier, east of Athens, in the region we now find, Iran or Iraq. He opens up the idea of a concept that is different in different times and places and always needing to change and adapt. Like freedom, it is a concept to be questioned, not blindly and blandly accepted as something concrete and immutable, even though it is now the most popular form of government on the planet. If core to the idea of representative democracy is a right to participate in the election of those who govern us and the acceptance that majority rules, who can be surprised that I would question democracy and its fragility when the government I voted for was sacked by our monarch's representative? And Jenny Hocking's book, The Dismissal Dossier, now makes plain that the palace was completely aware of what was going on. It was her research of John Kerr's private papers, only made accessible after 37 years, that revealed how much the palace knew, while we were being told they knew nothing. Her argument is that we had a right to know, that in this democracy we had a right to the truth. Incidentally, I was in rehearsal for my first Threepenny Opera the day Whitlam was sacked. I walked into the rehearsal room in Hindmarsh, and while director Wal Cherry and dramaturg John Willett were sparklingly aware, the rest of the company seemed undisturbed. Wal and John immediately changed the ending of the play so that it was the Governor-General who descended from the clouds in the finale and saved the robber Macheath's skin. In the subsequent production in the Playhouse here, this deliberate piece of political commentary seemed to go absolutely unnoticed over the heads of the audience. And I ask again and again, does art really matter does it ever really make a difference? Most recently, Yascha Mounk and David Runciman are among the many commentators on the current state of democracy. Yascha Mounk's The People versus Democracy, Why Our Freedom is in Danger and How to Save It, emphasises two emerging systems from the disintegration of liberal democracy. Illiberal democracy, he cites Switzerland, that is, democracy without rights, and undemocratic liberalism, or rights without democracy. He cites the European Union, whose decisions are made entirely by bureaucrats and a parcel of largely disengaged politicians. Once you have this kind of framework, daily events feel clearer to interpret. A couple of weeks ago, SBS Television News began with a report on the Turkish elections. It showed images of a massive opposition gathering with the comment, "It doesn't look like Turkish democracy is on the rocks," but followed with the commentary that this rally was not reported in the press or on Turkish television, which instead covered Erdogan's pet new project, a new airport. This is, of course, because of the government's control of mass media there. The report also added that during the state of emergency declared by Erdogan, 150,000 people have been detained. So, yes, people are free to vote, but what is the context of their vote? With victory, Erdogan has immediately begun the process of giving himself infinitely greater executive powers. That report on SBS was immediately followed by one from the USA with President Trump, just 2 days after endorsing more liberal treatment of illegal immigrant kids, giving a press conference surrounded by the families of people who had been killed by illegal immigrants. These are both examples of increasingly illiberal democracies, where greater restrictions in the mass media make it harder for citizens to determine the truth. Incidentally, in Runciman's appraisal of the US in his book, he tells us that violence there has increased by 10% in the last 10 years, that more than 50 people a month are shot to death in Chicago, and that suicide rates are up to the point where more Americans currently shoot themselves than shoot others. Can we any longer take seriously the jargon of democracy? Mexicans have just had a turnaround election. Will the new president and his left-leaning party be able to take steps to avoid the last decade's record of 200,000 drug murders and the murder of 133 politicians in the lead-up to those elections? Runciman, and his book is The End of Democracy, or How Democracy Ends, Runciman summarises, contemporary representative democracy is tired, vindictive, paranoid, self-deceiving, clumsy, and frequently ineffectual. Much of the time, it is living on past glories. But current democracy is not who we are. It is just a system of government which we built and we can replace. He says, there are good reasons for having stuck with democracy so far, and we may have been worse off without it. But clinging on too long could do as much harm as giving up too early. It could be even worse. Now, this is all stimulating reading, and there's not enough time tonight here to travel deeply into everything these commentators raise, but on the whole, it's pretty convincing that there's a crisis, and we only have ourselves to blame if we're not prepared to look squarely at the challenges and work for remedies. Right now, as beers and bands as the measure of success late night in our galleries, big numbers and box office as the main measures of success of our festivals, and the continuing image of our glorious landscape with a still deplorable lack of understanding of its meaning and ownership by its first peoples, you'd have to conclude that the lucky country is, despite the longer hours we're all working, a lazy country, not physically perhaps, but mentally, ethically, politically. And laziness would seem to be the perfect breeding ground for giving populism a free ride. I'm loath to draw exact parallels between that time I've spent so much cultural research on, that is, Berlin between the wars, and the United States, but clearly the preconditions were all there. A large part of the population doing it extremely tough and feeling disenfranchised, a popular orator rising to power through his promise of making the country great again and offering dangerously oversimplified solutions to complex problems and saying, "I know who is to blame, and I know how to fix it." Trump, of course, is not alone. Boris Johnson is playing the same game in oversimplifying the Brexit complexities. Again, we have to ask, how do we educate large numbers of voters, old and young, to dig beneath the surface of oversimplified solutions and dangerous promises? And how do we correct the laziness that just takes our political and cultural freedoms for granted? Now, I'm aware that we have a combined audience this evening, those here for the Festival of Ideas and those here for the dance conference. So let me just return for a moment to that notion of freedoms inside and outside democracy. I've never really considered myself a dancer, but I've done a lot of it. Yet when I look into my personal history of dance, there is a freedom there that many of us have experienced and rarely questioned. I recall with such joy the prosh breakfast at Adelaide Uni just after the release of the Sgt. Pepper's album. We stood on the trestle tables, pissed as farts at 8 o'clock in the morning, free dancing in a very, very 60s style and singing to the rafters, "All you need is love." I'm not one for nostalgia, but that moment is pretty irresistible. I know it never occurred to me that there were rules at other times and in other places about the way you danced, and in what context, or rules banning dance entirely. But of course, dance has often been subject to the restriction of freedoms. When it was first introduced, the waltz was considered too risque for many European societies. The idea of holding a partner was beyond the bounds of polite society. Men and women were not free to dance in that way. In colonial Cuba, the danzón afforded young men and women a rare opportunity to converse. The danzón is a kind of box step, waltz hold dance at a steady pace. I've been invited by young men and old to dance this one with them in Mexico City, especially in the marvellous Salón de Los Ángeles and Salón Colonia. At a certain point, the band doubles the pace, and this was the opportunity in colonial Cuba for the young couple to take a breather while remaining in the middle of the dance floor unchaperoned. At last, a private word or two could be had behind the cooling flutter of an elegant fan. I imagine cooing, courting words along the lines of, "I suppose a fuck would be out of the question." But let's not imagine that such forbidden scenarios are only a thing of the distant past. I believe that in Iran it is still not possible for women to perform in front of a mixed audience. In fact, when I attended the Faj Theatre Festival in Tehran, there was one momentous event in which women were allowed to sing in chorus in an opening event. That freedom, as I understand, didn't last. And in some cultures and genres, the rules of dance are very strict. In Japan, a young Mako going through her training of song and dance, the very specific rules of Thai or Burmese classical dance, even the rigours of Western ballet. Observing tradition often demands the limitation or modification of freedoms. And of course, we see this in the complex layering of meaning and ownership of First Peoples' cultural expression, both traditional and contemporary. Some 40 years ago, I undertook a DFAT tour to Southeast Asia. One of the surprising destinations was then titled Rangoon. The exotic featured loud in my excitement and anticipation. I was to be the first popular artiste to visit that country for 17 years, the entire period which followed the assassination of the majority of the elected parliamentarians, including their father of democracy, in their parliament house. Researching costume protocol, I had the superb designer Anna Senior fashion me a forest green pantsuit of trousers and waistcoat and a matching thin striped shirt with white collar and cuffs fastened by a pair of dad's cufflinks. Buttoned up is what we needed. There were many delays in sealing the engagement, and I was eventually informed that there had to be a full meeting of the Burmese cabinet to approve my visit. We were to be admitted on a number of conditions, one of which was Miss Archer would not engage in excessive bodily movement on stage. Let me add two small kodai to the story of that trip. The first is that when I arrived with my accompanist, the late great South Australian Jerry Wesley Smith, on a very hairy Air Bangladesh flight which had brought us from Dhaka, where we had performed the night before, the Australian ambassador to Burma met us at the airport to take us to the residence and inform us that we would have to perform that night on a stage in the splendid tropical garden of the residence to an audience of invited guests. This was structured to invite the deciding officials to witness our performance so they could make sure about the excessive bodily movement on stage and other aspects of the repertoire. Though our scheduled public concerts were to happen the following night, no tickets had yet been issued. Coda 2. Having been approved, the concerts went ahead in a big hall that looked as if it had been used as a chook house, but to an appreciative audience. Jerry mentioned that it was a shame we hadn't yet and were not being offered an opportunity to witness Burmese culture. After the second concert, we were asked to join the Minister of Culture and his small entourage in the auditorium. The minister was a musicologist educated in Moscow, and we were much in favour as we had worn on stage the magnificent orchid corsages brought to us, and we had both donned traditional elements of costume. Jerry wore a sarong. This was particularly appreciated since dress rules at the time were very strict. The singer who taught us a Burmese song to sing had been arrested and fined some weeks earlier for wearing Western trousers in a performance. The song he taught us happened to be the minister's number one hit in the 50s, so it seemed this persuaded him to heed Jerry's suggestion. That evening, with just a few of us watching, we experienced full performances of gamelan, chorus and dance, scores of performers, the like of which I had never experienced before and clearly summoned on the snap of a finger. Of all the Southeast Asian dance I had been aware of, this was the most exquisite and pure I had ever seen. It was perhaps precisely because of the strict cultural protectionism, the restriction of freedoms exerted by that government, that the tradition was preserved so absolutely intact. Beautifully costumed women appeared with such delicate movement, such modesty and elegance, and then the women dancers appeared. We'd actually been watching only male dancers in the whole of the opening sequence. Now Myanmar calls itself a democracy, but it is surely still one of Munk's democracies without rights. At the end of his book, Munk articulates his personal stance in the face of a crisis of democracy. He talks about the Stoics and the austerity of their approach, in which to gain control you must become indifferent to everything that surrounds you. He declares himself not to be a Stoic because he is not indifferent to the plight of loved ones or the poor or indeed the fate of democracy. But he finds wisdom in the teaching of the Stoics and writes, "When I am faced with the real danger, my incentives are always going to point me in the direction of inaction or acquiescence. I should probably say something, but what difference will it make? I should probably call them out on this, but how will I feed my family if I lose my job? I should probably stand up to the government, but what will I do if its loyalists come after me?" Agrippinus, then, he writes, was completely right on one important point. "If I wait for imminent danger to figure out what risks I'm willing to take, I am likely to lose myself in the one moment that truly counts. Long before I actually face a dangerous decision, I am building up the resolve to do the right thing. In the years to come, it may take more and more courage to stand up for what we hold dear." This is an admirable exhortation, but what still worries me is how. It was great to see the young Americans mobilise for gun control. Got a lot of media, a lot of admiration. Did it change anything? I like the way direct democracy worked in the debate around a nuclear waste facility here in South Australia. It was discussed, people on both sides spoke passionately, and in the end, our representatives decided that the people didn't want it and set it aside. Good result. What a shame, I think, there has been no such open consultation around the extended development of the casino here in Adelaide. Oh, what a sign that is. The god of gambling, of all that glitters in a world obsessed with money, brazenly erecting itself, I use the term knowingly, erecting itself in such shiny proximity to government and art and putting both to shabby shame. That's how free we have been here, not to have been given the opportunity to say this is possibly not what we ever wanted, maybe even not, after a good strong debate, what a majority wanted. And had we had the opportunity to protest, what would the response have been in the name of jobs and growth? Well, the taxes on reinvigorated gambling will help provide you with, for instance, a new cultural centre with a brand new spanking contemporary art gallery. Is that also the deal we would have agreed to? Are we all playing Mother Courage here? I should be singing the song of the grand capitulation, if we had even got that far, to register our choice. Even as we all in this room, I have no doubt, share a concern about the way the words freedom and democracy, jobs and growth are still being bandied about as unquestionables, even if we want to interrogate and object and question further, how do we do it? What avenues does this form of democracy actually allow? Of course, the arts could be one answer. But as I have been suggesting, even if these challenges are raised courageously in the arts, who exactly is listening? Who hears, and even if convinced, who acts? Over this weekend, you will be exposed to many ideas. But will you believe your duty is done simply to have heard the ideas and to have luxuriated in the exercise of your mind? It is, after all, a good thing to do. Do you believe that the expression of these many ideas, a privilege of our brand of democracy, also demands you take action on the things that you have found persuasive and which require urgent action? Richard Dennis offers some suggestions in his recent quarterly essay, Dead Right, How Neoliberalism Ate Itself and What Comes Next. He advocates the creation of a Charter of Rights, reminding us that, quote, while some laws grant some citizens some rights, Australia is the only democracy in the world that lacks a bill or Charter of Rights which no parliament can take away. He advocates the establishment of a National Interest Commission, the establishment of a federal corruption watchdog, and this accords with Munch's greatest hope for democracy, and that is monetary democracy. He asks for the insistence on democratic education and a sovereign wealth fund. Runciman resists solutions, but offers instead some lessons for the 21st century. Mature Western democracy is over the hill, he writes. Its prime is past. We ought to acknowledge this. He describes a successful 100-year run and that there are still benefits to be had in anyone's declining years. He writes, blithe confidence in the future would be ridiculous at this stage, but while democracy has life in it, it has to be lived. The history of democracy will not have a single endpoint unless all human life does. He says that there will be successes and disasters, but, quote, Western democracy will survive its midlife crisis. With luck, it will be a little chastened by it. It is unlikely to be revived by it. This is not, after all, the end of democracy, but this is how democracy ends. We are also earlier reminded that in 1992, Francis Fukuyama, in The End of History and The Last Man, put ultimate faith in liberal democracy. Runciman maintains that the collapse of the Japanese economic miracle put paid to that hope, but interestingly sees both Japan and Greece as perfect examples of how democracy has the ability to delay absolute disaster and just keep muddling along. Keane, in 2009, put his hopes in monetary democracy and, along with Mook, in the promise and necessity of healthy institutions that monitor what our elected representatives are getting up to. He actually used India as the best example. He refers to the enormous cynicism at the time of independence as to whether such a wildly diverse country could ever survive the departure of its British rulers and writes, the 60-year-old Asian democracy is not just the world's largest democracy, a convenient cliché, but also its most compound, turbulent and exciting prototype. Defined by various older and newer means of publicly monitoring and contesting power and representing citizens' interests at all levels, it reinforces the conviction of this book, that is his book, that democracy at all levels can be improved by changing people's perceptions and by humbling those who exercise power over others, and that the seeds of greater public accountability can be planted everywhere, from the bedroom and boardroom to the battlefield. So what do we do here now? How do we imagine what it will require to be active and effective in this crucial moment? I have often said of the arts and its endless quest for funding and support that if we could persuade the majority of the essential services we provide, then there would be no argument. The people would demand funding for the arts just the way they demand funding for health and hospitals and the other things that keep them well and make them whole. In the instance of Richard Dennis's practical solutions, we would have to find ways to change the political conversation away from money and back to what we actually believe in, and make it clear that our vote will go to those who will change the conversation, not just change the weight of the wallet. This is, after all, what Trump promised. Not that he's delivering, but he won on that promise, and that's what the populist framework is about. Can we ever get away from more money in the pocket and back to what might matter more to us in this moment? I had been considering thinking of calling this address Do the Arts Really Matter, or Have I Just Been Bullshitting All This Time? The German 20s and 30s repertoire I sing is filled with brilliant observations of the worst excesses of that time. Did it do any good? No. The German majority voted in the National Socialists on the back of a devastating depression, no jobs, no growth, that need to blame someone, that strong populist orator who persuaded them. In a time of great severity, starvation, poverty, they were willing, in one sense understandably, to trade freedoms on the promise of Germany being made great again. They were willing to submit to harsher rules and trade democracy for autocracy. The majority was persuaded by the strongest rhetoric to be complicit with the persecution and murder of artists and dissidents and homosexuals and, of course, the entire Jewish minority, enormous though that was. Runciman warns us that this is a very different world from 20s and 30s Europe and that we will not return to exactly that situation. It isn't identical, but it does point to similar forces at work, and we can certainly anticipate different but similarly dire circumstances if we continue just to accept that what has become empty slogans of freedom and democracy. This is perhaps a role that art can play, to identify empty or at least grossly misunderstood slogans and pierce through the hypocrisy and vested interests in maintaining this disguise. In the face of majority will, the artists whose works I continue to sing had no choice but to get out. Some of those who didn't were murdered, some committed suicide, even some of those who escaped. Many of the artists of these times suffered much more extreme consequences than unmediated shaming on social media. Some had success elsewhere but died early. Some were resilient to survive the whole thing. Brecht and his composer colleague Hans Eisler were survivors. No, they didn't stop the horrors of World War II. It was a mighty wave against which they were powerless. But there's this, and perhaps in terms of that concept of freedom, at least we know where they stood. At least we have evidence of their awareness and their position. Brecht wrote a poem, Im finsteren Zeiten, in dark times. They won't say when the walnut tree shook in the wind, but when the house painter crushed the workers. They won't say when the child skimmed a flat stone across the rapids, but when the great wars were being prepared for. They won't say when the woman came into the room, but when the great powers joined forces against the workers. However, they won't say the times were dark. Rather, why were their poets silent? I know it's not cool not to be full of hope and optimism, full of TEDx-type innovation and flash-at-the-hip entrepreneurialism, and thanks be that there are a heap of youngsters with this kind of energy. Surely some good will come from some of those flash ideas. But it also seems to be helpful to be aware. Do we dare say that we are in dark times? The devastation of the planet's finite resources and the unchallenged call for growth? The movement of population as not seen since the Dark Ages, and millions punished and living horrific conditions because of that forced need to move. As I tell tales in my concerts of those German artists at the peak of their careers in the 1930s, forced into exile and the need to reboot careers, are we sure we are welcoming and accepting the current tsunami of exiled professionals as well as America and Britain and Australia then did? There is currently widespread starvation and poverty. If we are supposed to be the beneficiaries of a global economy in which multinationals provide jobs and growth to this country, do the citizens of this country not have a global responsibility? Do we take seriously those responsibilities, both environmental and humane? Even in our own country, the original inhabitants die earlier from preventable disease and are incarcerated at rates way above their percentage in the population. Yet, their art is the most valuable artistic export we have. Is not this some version of the grotesque hypocrisy? In traditional democracies, freedoms are increasingly limited. In so-called democracies, the rapid implementation of autocracies, the daily taking of multiple lives through acts of guerrilla or sectarian or religious or official warfare, is this not a couple of shades dark at least? I look at this with as clear an eye as possible, worming my way through the mass of misinformation and trying to get at some version of the truth. And at the same time, I want to say I am hopeful that there are answers and there are solutions, there are smart people and good ideas and clear analysis, and the job, in perhaps for all of its shortcomings as transparent a democracy that currently exists, to persuade the majority to look more carefully, to question, to challenge, and to use our vote to put in place representatives who will make the changes we desperately need. As Dennis writes, the world is full of alternatives and choices. Neoliberalism's real power came from convincing us that we had none. We do. And making them is the democratic role of citizens, not the technocratic role of economists, nor of any self-serving elite. He also writes, democracies only work when citizens are engaged enough to set national directions and trusting enough to step back and leave the details to their delegates. Instead, according to the dictates of neoliberalism, Australians have been told to leave the big decisions to the experts, experts they no longer trust. So, can art play a role in any of this? Well, spending less time in providing creature comforts as if there is no urgency, as if there is nothing wrong, but instead assisting the efforts in creating awareness would help. And that doesn't mean it's all dire and dark. Artists are very, very good, like no others in our society, in creating awareness amidst awe and laughter and beauty. That's what we can do. And you know I make a distinction between art and entertainment. Entertainment is precisely that thing that comfortably preserves the status quo, and art is the stuff that stirs, not just in a masturbatory way, but stirs to action. Art that deserves to be called by that name is not comfortable. It will stir you out of your comfort zone, either through sheer overstimulation and excitement, or by arousing your passion or anger and stirring you to action. And in the end, even if the arts do not succeed in actually remedying evident wrongs, at least if they leave evidence of concern and effort, if successive generations can see that at very least we were concerned and understood what was wrong and what demanded change, then perhaps we could beg the same treatment that Brecht asked for one of his and Eisler's late elegies. Because if not, if all that is left of our age is happy ending musicals and comedies of manners, domestic dramas and thrillers, then perhaps the arts' claim for significance and centrality will be seen as mainly just a heap of BS. You will come to the surface of the overwhelming deluge which covered us. Just think about our weakness of that dark time, which all of you escaped. Yes, we went as often changing countries as changing shoes, through the wars of the classes, despairing each time we found an abuse and no sense of outrage. Nonetheless, we realize even hatred of debasement can distort your features. Even anger at injustices can make your voice hoarse. Oh, we who used to hope we'd created a basis for friendliness never could be friendly ourselves. You, though, when things are moving forward, so that man becomes a helper to other men, look back on us with indulgence.
Adelaide's Queen of the Arts, Robin Archer, speaking at the Adelaide Festival of Ideas in 2018. You've been listening to Think About It on Radio Adelaide. Our thanks to the Adelaide Festival of Ideas for today's speakers. You can check out their archive for yourself at adelaidefestivalofideas.com.au. Thanks too to Clayton Werner, Tim Carter and Nick Crowther. I'm Annie Hastwell. Do join us again next week on Think About It.